بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، والصلاة والسلام على رسوله الكريم وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. صلوات
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
I want to welcome you all again to the Thought Forum, an opportunity where we can discuss controversial topics that the Muslim world, especially in the West, is grappling with. And one of these controversial subjects is the concept of jihad. And we live in an environment now where the very word itself has become almost a bad word, a dangerous word. And this is why we want to raise this subject, jihad in Islam. Why are we afraid of the word, especially when the idea of jihad takes such a central position in Islamic law, in Islamic thought, and even in the process of developing ourselves. Tonight we have Sheikh Bahmanpour, who will be presenting on the subject, and then we will take questions. Just a couple of rules that I think we should observe in the Thought Forum. Everyone should be able to converse freely. And we should be able to practice tolerance and respect towards each other. In other words, we don't want people cutting in on each other's presentation or speech. And we encourage you all to participate because in questions or in comments, it does expand our knowledge of the subject. So without further ado, I'd like to turn the mic on to Sheikh Bahmanpour. Salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali
Muhammad. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillah rabbil alamin. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa alihi at-tahirin.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali.
The concept of jihad has always been a very holy concept in Islam. It's talked about in a very a beautiful language in the Quran, the sacrifice that people offer in jihad, the reward of mujahideen, which cannot be equal with any other worship. So there's no argument that jihad is a holy concept mentioned in the Quran in our traditions. Now, we have two types of jihad. And usually, in the modern day, some scholars try to refer all terms about jihad, all references about jihad and instances used in the Quran, refer it to one type of jihad, and that is jihadun nafs, fighting with one's own self. Combat with the self, so to speak. Of course, there's a tradition that once the Prophet, peace be on him, and his companions returned from one of the battles, and the Prophet told them, "We have come back from the lesser jihad, and now we have to embark on the greater jihad." And the companions asked, "Ya Rasulullah, what is the greater jihad?" And he said, struggle against one's own selfish desires. This is what is usually called al-jihadul akbar. The jihad in the battlefield is the smaller, lesser, easier jihad. Everyone can take part as long as they have the ability to take weapons and go. However, in jihadun nafs, battle against the selfish desires, not everyone can take part. Only those who are after purity, seeking to be purified, can take part in this jihad. And in this jihad, you are not fighting against anyone outside yourself. You fight against your selfish desires. You are a sort of, you try to find your enemy inside yourself. And that is, of course, more difficult. And that's why it's called the greater jihad. Now, of course, this is mentioned by the Prophet. And in the Quran, we have references to this jihad. Like, for example, at the end of Surah Al-Ankabut, وَالَّذِينَ جَاهَدُوا فِينَا لَنَهْدِيَنَّهُمْ سُبُلَنَا. Those who wage jihad in our way, for our sake. We have two terms which are used with a very small nuance in the Quran. Al-jihad fi Allah wal-jihad fi sabilillah. Jihad fi Allah is usually the reference to this greater jihad. Al-ladhina jahadu fina, those who wage jihad for our sake, we will guide them our ways. That means if you try hard, even if you don't have any mentor, even if you don't have someone to guide you, but if you struggle inside to find purity, God says that we will guide you. Don't worry. You do your part, you do your share, I'll do my share. I will guide you. Or, for example, towards the end of Surah Hajj, we have this beautiful verse, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, amanu taqullah, amanu u'budu rabbakum, usjudu warkaw. And then it comes to this, Wajahidu fillahi haqqa jihadih. Struggle for the sake of God the way he deserves. That is inward struggle, of course. The way he deserves is inward struggle. The verse is, Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu ruku'u wasjudu wa'budu rabbakum. I just remembered the beginning of the verse. Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu ruku'u wasjudu wa'budu rabbakum. And then it says in the course of the ayah, Wajahidu fillahi haqqa jihad. Now, this is jihad fillah. Then we have jihad fi sabilillah. There is, as I said, there is no question that Quran has referred to this greater jihad. We have to, as Muslims, we have to embark on this greater jihad if we really wish to go closer to God. However, the references that we have in the Quran about the lesser jihad are even more. And in many instances, there are references to it, and it is impossible to say that whatever reference in the Quran has come about the jihad is about the greater jihad, and we don't have the lesser jihad in Islam. It is totally absurd if someone talks like that. And I will mention some verses certainly. So, the two types of jihad. However, the lesser jihad, which we have had at the time of the Prophet, later on we had this lesser jihad, especially the jihad of Husayn ibn Ali, peace be on him, against Yazid. It was a jihad. It has its conditions. It has codes of practice, and it has its own definition. We cannot, as Muslims, because the Quran speaks about jihad, as Muslims we cannot define any act of violence to be jihad. This is absurd again. In the same way that somehow returning any reference to jihad, to the greater jihad, jihad on nafs, is absurd. From this side, defining any act of violence to be jihad, because we are Muslims and because we want to do it for the sake of God, in our own opinion, we cannot define it to be jihad. On this side, there's absurdity as well. So, initially we can say that, because this is a legal matter, jihad falls under the jurisdiction of the jurists and people who are experts in Islamic law, they have divided jihad into two different types. One is al-jihad al-ibtida'i, the jihad which the Muslims initiate on their own, without being attacked. They initiate the jihad. Offensive, I don't like the term offensive, because offensive means that, of course, you are offending others.
It means offense. Yeah,
an offense, yeah.
As opposed to defense.
Defense, yeah. Anyhow, I like to call it initiated jihad. Offensive jihad is a term which is usually used as well. And the other type is defensive jihad. That is when you are attacked and you have to defend yourself. Now, there are different rulings about these two, offensive and defensive, initiated or reaction, showing reaction to a war which is waged against you. There are different rulings here. Now, the aim of that offensive jihad, which was defined at the beginning, at the time of the Prophet, was to call people to Islam, to show them the way. Not forcing people to Islam, showing them the way, and then they were, of course, they had the option to choose. However, because at the beginning the sovereigns did not allow Muslims to go and preach Islam, so they had to somehow take the obstacle out of the way by a war, and then go and preach Islam. What happened, for example, in the case of Iran, Persia at that time. What happened? The obstacle was taken, the sovereign was toppled, and the da'wah of Islam penetrated the Persian lands. Now, the rate of conversion to Islam was so high in Persia that the second caliph wrote to his commanders in Persia that from today you do not accept conversion because this is causing problems in our administration. Because if people are not converted, they have to pay jizya. If they are converted, they have to pay zakat. And the amount is almost the same. It's not very, very much different. But keeping the book for it, and also there are other legal implications in that, that the second caliph ordered that from today you do not accept any conversion. But they couldn't help it. People had found a way, they wanted to convert to Islam. And you see, a country like Persia with that long, long culture, with that religion which had traditionally been the religion of the people for thousands of years, suddenly, in a matter of a couple of years, all converted to Islam. There was no resistance there. So that jihad, which was initiated or offensive, so to speak, it was to remove the obstacle. Now, here we have about one of the verses of the Quran which talks about the aims of this offensive jihad, so to speak. In Surah Ali Imran, وَمَا لَكُمْ لَا تُقَاتِلُونَ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ وَالْمُسْتَضْعَفِينَ مِنَ الرِّجَالِ وَالنِّسَاءِ وَالْوِلْدَانِ الذين يقولون ربنا أخرجنا من هذه القرية الظالمة أهلها واجعل لنا من لدنك وليا واجعل لنا من لدنك نصيرا. Why should you not fight in the way of God and the abased men, women and children who say, our Lord, bring us out of this town whose people are wrongdoers and appoint for us a guardian from you. These are the people in Mecca who are calling for the Prophet to go and somehow freedom from that oppressing sovereignty which was controlling Mecca, and appoint for us a helper from you. And in this way, actually, the Quran is encouraging Muslims to go for fighting. This is the aim, to free people from oppression, to guide people towards Haqq, waj'al lana min ladunka waliya, a guide and a helper you give us. Now, there is no argument that at the time of the Prophet, this was the aim of the offensive jihad and afterwards. However, according to the Shia view, the offensive jihad is only permissible when there is the prophet, when there is the Prophet, peace be on him, when he is alive, or an imam who is immaculate, free from any selfish desires. At the time of occultation and ghiba, the offensive jihad is not permissible. And probably the reasoning behind it is that people, the kings, the rulers, may say that we want to go and fight for the sake of God and propagate faith. However, they may have other, of course, stimulus and desires behind this, which is the case. I mean, we had at the time of the Abbasids and Umayyads, many of these battles were not for just propagation and proselytizing Islam. It was for power. So, at that, according to the Shia view, this type of war, the offensive, is only permissible when the Imam or the prophets would lead the jihad. So now, for the Shia, there is no such a thing as initiating a war against another country, saying that we want to bring Islam to the people. For the Sunnis, it's different. However, it doesn't mean that everyone or anyone, any group of people, can just take weapon and say, we want to go and fight against the other country to take Islam to that people. It should be organized with a leader who is regarded as a caliph. And nowadays, in the Muslim world, we don't have any caliph, because the caliph had ended by Ottomans. We don't have any caliph anymore. Just the idea of not having any caliph, I'm talking about the Sunni world now, would actually forbid Muslims to take any sort of action, initiating a war, because war should be sanctioned by a caliph. According to us, of course, by the imam, which is now in occultation, and according to Sunnis, this should be done by, this should be, the permission should be issued by a caliph or someone in his place, which is not possible at the moment. So we rule out the possibility of the offensive jihad, initiating a jihad against any other people because they have other religions, because we want to bring Islam to their people. This is not permissible now. So what is permissible now? What is the meaning of jihad? Jihad should not be confused with terrorism. Nowadays, jihadists, what we have in mind of jihadists is just taking bombs, tying bombs to oneself and going to explode it somewhere, especially among civilians. This is major in most of the cases, it's done among civilians. This is certainly not permissible. This is terrorism. This is not jihad. And if they are thinking about that offensive jihad, say, for example, they do it in other countries to say we want to establish Islamic rule here, this is absolute confusion of things. Now, with regards to defensive jihad, and that is when Muslim territory is attacked by, is invaded, either by a Muslim oppressor, like when Saddam Hussein attacked Iran, backed by the whole world, of course, the whole Western world, Western and Eastern. You know, 70% of the weapons given to Saddam was given by Russia. The other 30% was given by France and helps of AVEX by America and other things. So the whole world was supporting this oppressor. Now, although he was claiming to be a Muslim, but it was an oppressor attacking another Muslim country. In this case, jihad becomes wajib, obligatory. Or non-Muslims attacking Muslim lands. In that case as well, jihad becomes obligatory. And this jihad does not need any permission. You do not wait until someone allows you to fight. It is not, you have heard that jihad is not permissible for women in Islam, isn't it? Jihad is not, it's only something that men can do. That is for offensive jihad. A jihad which is initiated by Muslims to call to Islam, which we discussed, in that case, it's not obligatory on women. However, defensive jihad is obligatory on everyone, on men, women, anyone who can just defend or do something, it is obligatory. And in this case, of course, we have a rational understanding of human reaction. I mean, you attack any country, all moral and ethical codes would tell the people of that country that you have to defend your country, you have to defend your nation, you have to defend your people. It is absurd to say that, well, we come and attack you, you don't do anything because that's violence. If you react, that's violence. No. So, what in my mind, what's happening in Afghanistan now? I think not killing civilians, of course. Killing civilians is, according to the codes of war in Islam, you are not allowed to kill civilians. What's happening if groups are formed and they are fighting against the invaders and occupiers, or in Palestine? I think we can call it a jihad because it's a defensive act. You don't need anyone to tell you. You don't need any leader to declare jihad. Declaring jihad is one you want to actually initially go to battle. When you are defending, you don't need anyone to tell you. It's just like someone intrudes your home, just comes into your home, you defend yourself. The same thing with countries. So that is something which, of course, there's no question about it. I don't think any human being in the world, Muslim or non-Muslim, religious or non-religious, would say that this is something which is against ethical codes of human behavior. It is very ethical, very moral to do jihad. And therefore, yes, of course, should non-Muslims be afraid of jihad? Only in one case, if they attack. And if they attack, of course, they shouldn't be afraid that Muslims should come and kill the civilians. That is a political reaction. That is something which has nothing to do with Islam. But yes, they have to be afraid, like the way Hezbollah fought against Israel in Lebanon. We are very proud of it. We don't say that's terrorism. We say it's jihad, because there were occupiers going there, and they fought against them. Or like Americans or Russians attacking Afghanistan. We are, of course, we are proud of the people who fought against the military, not proud of the people who, of course, kill civilians. Now, there are certain verses in the Quran, my time is up, just quickly, certain verses in the Quran which are often mentioned out of context to somehow criticize Muslims about the way they think about non-believers or non-Muslims. For example, there are certain verses taken from Surah Toba, verse number 5. When the sacred months have passed, kill the polytheists wherever you find them. Capture them and besiege them and lie in wait for them at every ambush. I remember once in a program on the BBC that they were reading these verses saying that these are the Muslims. This is what they want to do with us. But if they repent and maintain the prayer and give the zakat, then let them alone. Indeed, Allah is all forgiving, all merciful. Or 36, verse 36, وَقَاتِلُ الْمُشْرِكِينَ كَافَّةً. Fight all the polytheists, just as they fight you all. Or verse 123, all you who have faith, fight the faithless who are in your vicinity. Now some say that, okay, our neighbors are faithless, we go, they are in our vicinity, we go and fight them. And we are allowed to kill non-Muslims. just like that, because they are non-Muslims, they are allowed to kill them because of all these verses. Now, this is absolutely taking these out of the context. This is when the Prophet declared war. And in a situation of war, of course, you have a strategy. You say, who is my enemy, who is not my enemy? And, of course, there is provision of peace here as well. If they want peace, make peace with them. So it is not for the time of peace, it's for the time of war. Just like, for example, if there is a war between between Britain and Germany, then they say that any German soldier found, kill them. Well, no one would say this is wrong. Or any attacker should be killed. So these verses are not about polytheists and faithless when you are in a state of peace or when you are living outside this state of war. This is a declaration of war. Surah Tawbah, the beginning of Surah Tawbah, is a declaration of war against the polytheists of Jaziratul Arab, of Mecca and around it, Medina, Mecca and around it. And this was a temporary sort of course, measure. Otherwise, for example, in Surah Mumtahana, we have about the mushrikun and about faithless, that لا ينهاكم الله عن الذين لم يقاتلوكم في الدين ولم يخرجوكم من دياركم أن تبروهم وتقسطوا إليهم إن الله يحب المقسطين. Allah would not forbid you to make friendship and to do good to those polytheists, faithless, who have not fought you for your religion and have not ousted you from your land. Two, to be good with them, tabarruhum, even to give them favors, to do them favors. Allah is not, of course, certainly forbidding you to do that. So these are the toasts that we want to put in tonight's discussion. Certain questions, is what some jihadis do today jihad? Of course, I discussed this, but we can discuss it further. Maybe there are some other thoughts as well. Should the world be afraid of jihad of Islam? Or in what case they should be afraid of jihad? What are your thoughts about jihad in the modern world? These are the things that we want to discuss.
Brother, it was a very interesting talk, but there are some other types of jihad. For example, the biggest jihad is Kalma-e-Haq in front of the tyrant or oppressor ruler. And the another type of jihad is the against your own conscience, the nafs ke khilaf, you see. So, would you like to say something?
Maybe you came a bit late because I discussed about this jihad of nafs at the beginning.
Okay, sorry.
The time of Prophet.
Badr was
in history, there is hardly any fighting.
The only one was conquest of Mecca, in which no fight took place actually. Absolutely. But it was an invasion anyhow. And Prophet also moved towards Rome, hearing that they were trying to make some movements.
He used to send delegations to offer the religion first before.
Yeah, that's right. So not many, yes. Certainly there were those who actually converted themselves. And even those people whose lands were conquered initially. I mean, if people do not will to convert, no one can force them. Those lands which were conquered initially, they were mostly Ahlul Kitab, and there was no force whatsoever. And even the desire of Muslims were for these people to remain Ahlul Kitab, because it had benefits for them if they did not convert to Islam. But, I mean, they converted to Islam. If you convert people by force, as soon as the force is taken, they will go back.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you, Shaykh Barak Alafi, for the nice speech. Actually, when we go back to unfortunately, Middle East and what's happening in Middle East and some Muslim countries like Pakistan. I saw actually a YouTube film just 3 days ago about Pakistan Shia killings. They are killing them in a very, very, very bad way. You know, they cut the heads like they are doing in Syria as well, actually.
Ruthless.
But I saw even a picture.
Ruthless is the word you are.
Yeah, yeah,
ruthless.
Yeah. They even I saw even a picture there where they had cut the bodies as well in pieces. So and they call of course that as jihad the problem. I saw another YouTube film. They had a child maybe he was only what could he be? He may be 10 years, not more. He was singing a jihad song. And he was saying, they gave him even a weapon knife, and he saw that we cut the heads of the Shia, and if the world called that terrorism, no, this is the jihad, he said. So, of course, this is clearly not the jihad. When they kill unguilty people, when they kill in that ruthless manner, it's absolutely not jihad, and it's a very bad picture of the jihad.
But these people are totally ignorant, illiterate, and nothing to do with their Islam. They have no background of any knowledge, any status. They're just the mob to do. And they are being exploited for political, for economical, for other reasons. I think that is the underlying reason for that. It may not be the Shia Sunni. And there will be a repulsion, of course, definitely, to every action. There is an equal and opposite reaction from the Shia side as well. So we have to analyze on those
theories. Attack Shias like this, could we justify or see in Shia Islamic law that we would be entitled to that type of reaction? I mean,
which one I would assume
would be terroristic, because you're talking about equal and opposite reaction and they're killing innocent kids and women and children. could the Shia do that? Do we have any example of us behaving this way?
Well, certainly it's not allowed. Whether they do it there, I don't know. But this is not jihad, this is savagery. This is an act of the biggest crime that a person can actually commit. And therefore, no Shia is allowed to react or to somehow retaliate in the same way, especially if you retaliate an act which is done by someone against other people. That is certainly not allowed.
Yes, I just wanted to say, I think this is a very, very important subject that you've picked, and we need to talk about it more, because there's a lot of misunderstanding just around this word all around the world, which is why we're targeted really easily. So, and you know, I appreciate the fact that you've chosen this subject. And also I wanted to say that I personally myself, I learned at a very later age about the types of jihad. So I, being a Muslim, wasn't even aware of it. So you can imagine there's so many people out there who really don't know the real meaning behind it. So I think what I wanted to say is, what are the other ways we should discuss more methods of telling the world, I mean, what really it is, and we should come up with more ways or run more campaigns, mainly, to tell people what is jihad in Islam. And so it's very nice that, you know, you brought that up. And also, I was just paying attention to this verse in the Quran where it says, but if they repent and maintain the prayer, if you think about it, it's kind of like, it makes sense that a person would only repent if they have, you know, if they're at fault. So someone has obviously done something wrong, which is why God is saying, if they repent. So it's quite clear that, you know, someone initiated the war in those times, and that's why this verse probably came, and, you know, God told the prophet and the people to go. So, I mean, if you pay attention, you know, people take things out of the context very easily. And this is what's happening, and we're being targeted from everywhere. So I think what I wanted to say was that we should come up with more ways of addressing the subject, because I think it's really, really important. Because they're labeling us, you know, people with jihadists and whatnot on news as if it's some kind of a marketing campaign, and, you know, just talk about it and make Muslims and Islam look bad. But, you know, we as Muslims, we need to be more proactive, and we need to come up with ways of how can we tell people what is the meaning behind it. We need to basically run more campaigns on this, I think. So thank you for choosing the topic.
Just to echo what the gentleman said on the right here, what we have in countries like Pakistan now are actual agents who are paid by superpowers to influence young people to go and blow up mosques and fellow Muslims. These are all paid agents. And I think that if you look at the history of Pakistan, the areas of Pakistan where I originate from, we have a lot of Shia brothers and sisters living in the same neighborhood. We eat from the same plate. For the ordinary person, it is not an issue. And the fact remains that, like people like Zarqawi did in Iraq, these are purely people put there to divide us. So I think that is an issue that needs to be made. But I've just got one further question here. Disease, illness, be considered to be a jihad as well, if that illness is so overpowering that it disables a person. Because I have found that there are some ayats in the Quran that help a person. So can that be considered as a jihad as well?
Jihad is literally means to struggle, to make efforts. And therefore, in its literal meaning, it could be applied to anything. And that's why it has been applied to two completely different sort of issues. When you struggle against your nafs, it's called jihad. Struggling to find your way towards God is called jihad. وَالَّذِينَ جَاهَدُوا فِينا. And also, yes, it could be applied to any other thing, like, for example, struggling for uprooting disease, struggling for the poor, it could be called a jihad as well. However, technically here, jihad means qital, fighting. And the Quran also uses the term qital, qatilu, that fight against the mushrikun. And therefore, one aspect of jihad is this qital or fighting. There are other aspects of jihad as well. Yeah.
I've got a question, but it's separate from this. The jihad of the woman is in the home, as I've heard from different hadith from the imams. I heard you...
the jihad of the woman is?
In the home, as I've heard, with her husband and her kids. I heard you say in defensive war, the jihad is of the woman is women, children, and everything is everywhere, basically. How does that fit in exactly?
Well, offensive jihad, not about defense. Actually, defense is something which all human beings agree that. I mean, when the enemies are attacking you, and they may come to your home, I mean, they do not discriminate between men and women, and we do not discriminate in defense. And therefore, that is when, of course, everyone should take part in defense. Yeah. Of course, sometimes there are somehow occupations which drag on, and then there are organizations who fight against that occupation. In that sense, we don't say that, but yes, we have to bring women as well to fight because there is sort of division of responsibilities. However, it is not something which women cannot do. For initiative jihad, they cannot do, but this one is not something that they cannot do.
Sir, I would like to answer our brother here that not all the Sunni are terrorists. Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam, he classified the Sunni to three types. The first type, they love and they support Ahlul Bayt, Salatullahi wa Salaamu Alayhi. And that is, he classified them as Mu'min. believer. The second type, who love Ahlul Bayt, and he classified them as a Muslim. The third type, who hate Ahlul Bayt, and that is a kafir type. So in our life, whenever we meet our Sunni brothers, we tell them this hadith belongs to Imam al-Hassan, and they should themselves classify themselves which one they are. The second one is a question I would like to ask. Saddam, in 1990, he sent a letter to Imam Khamenei. He said to Hazrat Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Khamenei al-Azim. Imam Khamenei. He called him, "You are the greatest." He said, "The Arab disappoint me. And now I am in trouble. And I would like to ask for your help. I don't have any further conversation what was going on, but I want to ask you your opinion as a Muslim state, what it will be the situation."
I remember when, before his execution, when he was in the court, he announced many times that, remember, the Iranians, Iran is our worst enemies. So how could it be possible that he wrote such a letter before? I mean, where is the reference? I do not agree. Thank you.
Just before the First World War, the First Gulf War, Saddam was already surrounded and he knew that the war is going to happen with all the atomic inspectors and nuclear inspectors going and coming and going and coming. And he started writing letters. He wrote even to Nelson Mandela, South Africa, asking for help. He sent a letter to our Tanzanian president, to all the African presidents, to all the Southeast Asian presidents in their own different contexts. What the brother mentioned was, he wrote a letter to Imam Khamenei, addressing him as the supreme leader of the Muslims. And having been deceived by the Arabs, he's turning to now to the Iranians. So he's bringing back the same folly that the Muslims were having there between Arabs and Iranians. And he did not even mention anything to do with the enforced, imposed war of 1888. And that was the most surprising thing everybody was surprised about. But he had written to all the other South America. He had written to Castro also for help. A desperate man would ask for help from anyone and everyone. So that was a letter, part of the letter. The rest, all other United Nations members had received in one way or the other, the letter asking for help.
He was in the greatest trouble of his lifetime. He never visited any country while he was a president for 30 odd years. He was so arrogant. He was so stupid, I should say, you know. I think in the history, not many rulers are such stupid you will find in the world, in the world, especially in the Baghdad. So it is under the circumstances he tried to exploit our mercy. He was fighting with Iran for 11 years with Ayatollah Khomeini and then going for help to him. Normal person cannot think on this line, you see.
Quite right that even Tariq Aziz, when he visited Iran at the start of the war, he wanted help from Iran, no question about it. But I would like, just like to mention this, that amongst almost all the Sunni schools of thought, Imam Hussein alayhi salam is the Shaheed Adam. He is the ultimate example. So I'd just like to emphasize that.
I have a question.
Is it related to this?
It's connected to jihad.
No, to this particular topic that was raised about Saddam.
No.
Okay. So let's deal with this topic, let's finish this topic. Any more comments on this?
You see, I remember the letter, and I don't know which one you are referring to. There was one just before he attacked Kuwait, and he wanted help. and this is the first letter he wrote, I think. That was, I think, what he wrote to Ayatollah Rafsanjani, that let's be friends with each other. There are bigger enemies that we have to fight against, and him and Kuwait, of course, and all the treasury and everything that he wanted. Actually, he realized that it was a mistake to attack Iran. There were more pleasant morsels that you could take more easily, like Iraq, or like Kuwait. Why did he come and fight against Iran? He was fooled by a sophisticated Western machination to attack Iran, thinking that it was an easy game to take. So he wrote that, and secondly, of course, when he was in trouble, the problem is that no one ever trusted in whatever Saddam said. I mean, although you may be ruling Muslim people, and you say, now I'm in trouble, please help. There are two aspects. When is the Muslim people are in trouble, and they are asking for help, just like what this verse is. The other one is when an oppressor is in trouble, should we go and help him? Actually, that letter divided minds in Iran as well. There were certain people who later on become reformists who said that now we are facing with someone like Khalid ibn Walid. Although he was very bad, but he repented. So Saddam is Khalid ibn Walid of our time, so we have to help him. This was a very simplistic sort of view, seeing Saddam like this, that he has repented. And I mean, a man like Saddam, who just easily killed tens of thousands of people, he doesn't just overnight repent and say, now I'm in trouble, come and help us. No, he just wanted to drag everyone in so that he prolonged his destiny. So it was certainly a very, very clever and apt move by Iran to keep away Absolutely. From the trouble. Mm. Otherwise, God knows what would have happened now. And of course, the Iraqis got rid of Saddam anyhow.
Yeah, I've got a point about, you raised an issue about Palestine and how there's a defensive jihad there these days. Obviously, some of the tactics used, which some say is a jihad, is also these explosions, you know, suicide attacks, and sometimes by Hamas or other groups. And sometimes these are killing innocent people. Now, you emphasise that the killing of innocents is haram, we shouldn't do it. And you also said that we shouldn't be, you know, we shouldn't stoop to the level of the people that attack us in the same way. So where do we stand on this? You know, my thoughts are that we should never do that. We should never kill civilians, ever. So I just like to understand your point of view there.
The so-called terrorist attacks inside the occupied Palestine. I was referring to what Hamas is doing against the Israeli army when they attack. And any measure they take against the Israeli army, that's jihad. But against civilians, as I said, killing civilians is not something that at least is called jihad. It's not called jihad. And not something that we would support and promote. I mean, America can call Hiroshima and Nagasaki collateral damage. I mean, killing 200,000 people just for defending myself is collateral damage. And sometimes you attack a military base and a couple of people are hurt there. And this is another type of collateral damage. I think we have to have a clear view about what collateral damage is. Most of the attacks in Afghanistan nowadays by drones have more collateral damage than the targeted damage. And could we really say that this is acceptable or not? I mean, in any war you have collateral damage. That's the case. However, we have to see whether the collateral damage is exceeding the damage which in a war or in a battle is being inflicted on an army or on the fighters or not.
From anybody at this moment, but if you look at about the jihad, but if you look on the other hand, No, 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 not offensive. If he orders to go for jihad for any place where it is required. So at this moment in Palestine,
Who orders?
If the Imam of the time or the Prophet of the time will come, as he mentioned earlier, if there was a Prophet and he asked to go and do offensive jihad. So at this present time, we don't have any authority. And we clearly see that there is a oppression going on in Palestine. And it is the aggression by non-Muslims who are doing it continuously. Is it the duty of every single Muslim to go and fight with, along with Palestinians?
I mean, what Palestinians are doing is defensive jihad.
It is, that's what I'm saying, defensive
and
jihad.
And it does not somehow exclude other Muslims to go and fight alongside their brothers. They can do it, of course, because it's defensive. Well, when I say the Imam is needed for the proclamation of jihad, it means when you are attacking another country to bring them to the fold of Islam. That is where the Imam is needed. However, if a Muslim people are attacked, it's upon everyone to go and help. This is what actually Imam Khomeini was preaching right from the beginning, that it is our duty to help our brothers in Palestine. And nowadays you see there are certain people who say, oh, they are Sunni, we are Shia. I think Imam Khomeini put an end to all this type of discourse. Sunni, Shia, we have to look after ourselves. And he said, if people are Muslim and they need help, we have to go and help. Even non-Muslims, if they need help, we have to go and help. What about the Muslim brothers, sir? Do they have any way to go there and
over? They have a way to go to Mali, Taliban have a way to go to everywhere in this
world. Well, because that is facilitated for them by certain powers, of course. I mean, those jihadists who go to Syria, it's facilitated for them to go there, or those who go to Mali and other places. It's very different from Gaza, for example, which you cannot even take provisions of food there. Let alone people go.
So isn't our duty to expose the facilitators at least? To tell the world that who are the facilitators?
Yeah, we tell, but who listens?
Which brings up me to a question here myself. What interests do you see behind this jihadi phenomenon? You know, where you have these fighters who commit these atrocities, for example, and you have, as the brother had mentioned, you know, there's no encouragement for them to contribute in fighting a defensive jihad against Muslim popular, you know, for Muslims. But instead, you know, you find this type of jihadism tending towards so-called jihadism tending towards a sectarianism, for example. So what kind of interests do you perceive behind this?
Vested interests,
yeah.
Well, it's very clear, of course. I mean, the best example is when the Afghan Mujahideen were supported by Americans against the Russians, and also Taliban were supported as well. There was vested interest there. Then, of course, they turned against them. Now they are using these jihadis wherever they want, and I think at the surface there's always complaint about the jihadis, why are they doing this? But I think when we go into depth of it, they don't mind this to happen. They don't mind, of course, Syria facilitating all jihadis to go there and fight against other Muslims. And they don't mind supporting them, they don't mind giving them weapons. They are giving weapons to al-Nusra in Syria, and they are fighting against al-Nusra in Mali. I mean, if this is an ally, why are you doing this? It's all vested interests. And unfortunately, of course, this is somehow supported by Muslim leaders who are totally seeing their interests tied to the interests of the superpowers. And we have a very, very terrible situation. I don't know, we should just have to seek the help of God to bring us out of this terrible situation.
Inshallah. Okay, moving on to the next question, which is, should the world be afraid of jihad, the jihad of Islam? Should the world be afraid of the jihad of Islam? Maybe I should probably even clarify it a little bit. You know, there are two types of jihad here, if you want to say that, right? One is the jihad that is based in Islamic law, as the Sheikh had outlined, and then on the other hand, they have the quote-unquote jihadi phenomenon, you know, that tends to threaten people all over the world. You know, should the world be afraid of the jihad of Islam?
Israel is of attacking nature. You know, they didn't want Iran to get, for example, the S-300 or Syria as well. And they were pressed on Syria together with USA, so they didn't sell that S-300 to them. But the world, they have the right to be that because of those jihadists we have today, mashallah, very active in our communities. In Middle East and Muslim countries. And unfortunately, they are killing Muslims, but before they did that things in USA, for example, and here in London. And of course, this was agents, as our brother told here, because these things can't happen just of real Muslims. But of course, the jihad, which is the real jihad in Islam, the world wouldn't be afraid of. But unfortunately, they don't know that. The picture has been not clear for them because of all these jihadists working today.
Well, I think jihad of Islam, if it is the real jihad of Islam, then the world shouldn't be afraid of it.
Why?
Because as he mentioned earlier in his speech that the greater jihad of Islam is to the jihad of nafs, and you know, fighting your own disease and you know, making yourself. So when you make yourself practically something better human being, you can be example for others.
Yeah, but I think this question isn't really addressing itself as asking the question with respect to the jihad of nafs, because it's something internal and something personal. Yes, brother.
Well, for me, I guess it does depend on who we're talking about. Now, I don't think the whole world should be scared of jihad of Islam, because jihad of Islam is, as we said, a defensive one. So I think it's the oppressors that should be scared of jihad of Islam, and everyone else. You know, we can't be offensive in our jihad these days, so no one else has a...
We're talking about common people. And if a common person, no matter who they are, if they just pick up a book, the right book, and read about it, and understand what jihad really is in Islam, so basically get the knowledge, they would not be afraid of it. What they should really be afraid of is the fact that their governments are lying to them all the time, their media is lying to them all the time, and they're being lied to all the time. So this is what they should be afraid of. They should not be afraid of the word jihad or, you know, the jihad of Islam. The fact that, you know, what they're told in the news and the channels that, you know, there's these people called jihadis and they're coming to get you. This is not what they should be afraid of. Because if a person picks up a book and reads about it or comes to these discussions or asks us, we'll tell them the real truth. So they would not be afraid of it. They'll actually wake up. So common people, you know, all we can say to them is read about it. Get to know from the real Muslims. Don't just listen to what's being told to you on the TV. So they should actually be afraid of the fact that they're being lied to about a lot of things. So that's what should really worry them.
I think there is a great element of the misunderstanding, misinterpretation between the two groups, Muslim and the non-Muslim. And there has been no dialogue to understand each other's feeling. And the things have been exaggerating just like that.
Well, the presentation of what is Islam is a bit skewed, you know, towards the direction of those people who are going away from Islam, those people who are misusing the idea of jihad and so on, you know.
Yeah.
Recently I was reading in the news, for example, that they were talking about some people from Britain going to Syria and fighting.
and the possibility of them coming back here, you know, with weapons training, with training in making IUDs and so forth, you know, which could threaten this environment, this society, you know. And I mean, personally, I'm very concerned about that, you know, in terms of, you know, being afraid, not in terms of being scared, but being concerned about security and safety in our society based upon this skewed idea of jihad. You know, any comments on that?
Well, I think the what we nowadays call jihadism, or this terrorist sort of interpretation of jihad, is due to a situation and a precedent which was not brought about by Islam. I mean, terrorism, we don't have any precedents of terrorism in Islam. Terrorism initially started when a group of, some groups in early stage of Israeli inception, they tried to actually eliminate the enemies. So terrorism started from there. Others learned from it. So Muslims have learned terrorism as a tool that could be used against the enemy. This is not something which was in Islam. And anyone saying that all these texts are telling us that, yes, terrorism is allowed, they're wrong. Before that, there wasn't a question. So the precedent is set outside Islam. And when you set a precedent, it's used against you. Just like this cyber war, the Stuxnet they used against the Iranian nuclear computers. Now, if you start a cyber war, you will be attacked by a cyber war. And people learn. You see, people learn, oh, this is something which is possible. You attack it this way, we attack it this way. And terrorism was something which was learned by Muslims. It was not there. And also, the situation, which again is not created by Muslims, have led people to react in a violent way. They have no other way to express their anger. And if you somehow press people to such a corner so that they cannot express their anger except by these ways which they have learned from others, then of course, this is what we see. It is not something which initiates from Islam. It is something which has initiated from the 20th century world order, from the way the whole Muslim world was divided by the conquerors, and the way they somehow set Muslims against each other, and the way they actually created a country in the middle of that area. The whole ball was set rolling in that way. And now we are faced with such a situation that no one knows how to solve it. And then they attribute it to Muslims, to Islam. It's completely wrong. If we go back a little bit in the history, we see that this has not been the case. The terrorism did not start with Muslims. It started somewhere else. And Muslims learned it. When I say Muslims learned, it means some youngsters learned that this is the way that we can go and attack. And they did it. And of course, no matter how you preach, when people are angry, they do not listen. And I think this is why the situation has come about. Yes, they have to be afraid, the world has to be afraid, not of jihad in Islam, but of this situation. This is a situation which is not going to benefit anyone. Tomorrow, other people may start using this method of terrorism. So anyone, who uses an evil method, they actually are not using it only once. And they are not using it in their own benefit only. Because other people who learn would come forward and use the same tactics and same methods.
He said, the problem between us and America is not a nuclear. The problem is a system of government led by Iran, I call it State of God, And America and the West, they call it the game of democracy. The people are fed up in the West from this system. And at the moment, the only alternative system is Iran system. And the biggest problem for the West with Iran is the Islamic Bank. And
I hope you're going to tie this in with jihad, you know.
Because
I hope you're tying this in with jihad.
Yeah, yeah, the Sheikh, he was mentioning the war with the West, or they call the Islamic terrorists or Islamic nuclear bomb. This is what
No, we're talking about no Islamic nuclear bomb. We're talking about should the world be afraid of jihad in Islam?
But
or the jihad of Islam?
He didn't mention the nuclear...
No, he's talking, you see, the gist of his... I should let you say that. I think the gist of his presentation...
Studying, getting knowledge, and do... We Muslims should learn every possible, should learn. I'm sometimes confused between these two. Yeah, we should learn about everything, actually, every knowledge. That's a part of our jihad, I think. And we have, mashallah, the ability to do that and the utility to do that. Except some knowledges which are forbidden for us, maybe, but we can do that on the knowledge side. And as well, we can, I think, do idea jihad or philosophic jihad. It is very important that we should play, maybe, which I would even maybe read the verse 375 about it. This is our jihad, that we bring the Islamic philosophy, the Islamic ideas to this world, to take them out from this
system.
Yeah, from this system and from this spiritual disguidance they have. That the things which, of course, the best jihad is that we actually build up ourselves first before going out, because if we go out and we aren't built up quite good, then we are weaker for doing anything.
Take the form of the struggle to achieve knowledge, the struggle to develop a philosophy that could, I guess, combat the erroneous philosophy that we find in today's world, and also the struggle to propagate Islam, right?
Yeah.
Okay, any other suggestions? Brother behind you.
There is obviously Jihad al-Asbar, where we have a lot of people which think they're performing Jihad al-Asbar these days, and obviously that it's being manifested through terrorism, which obviously is incorrect. So what we need to think about is, you know, how do we prevent this ideology coming up? So I think we need to actually really engage with younger people in the modern ways, modern mediums that we have these days, which is perhaps social media is the most popular way of communicating these days. So, you know, should we be seeing more sheikhs on Twitter or Facebook, etc.? And obviously, I think a lot of them have already embraced YouTube, which is, you know, progression. So I think if we actually look at Jihad al-Akbar and try and encourage more individuals to reach Jihad al-Akbar, then through this taqarrub to Allah, so by getting closer to Allah, then maybe we can actually prevent them from going down a stray path into thinking they're carrying out Jihad al-Asbar when really there's no need for it.
Well, to educate our youth is very, very important, because for the future, they're the ones who are going to fight for our imams, for our imam. For Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, they're the ones who are gonna basically be a part of the army for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Ajla Allah farajahu. So I think to educate them, to do things to give our knowledge to them is very, very important in the modern world. To educate ourselves first in order to educate them is very important in defining ways, basically. I think that's the first step we need to take.
Encourage people to do the greater jihad, educate the youth and remove the misconceptions, right? Okay, now I want to put something out here. Now, the Sheikh had mentioned offensive jihad as something being the exclusive preserve of the Holy Prophet and the Imam Salam, right? And that offensive jihad is basically to remove the obstacles for the spread or growth of Islam, okay? Now, we live in a society that has many obstacles to the spread and growth of Islam, okay? But we do not have the right to wage a jihad against the society because of the reasons expressed before. Couldn't we say that a contemporary jihad would be to try to change those objective negative conditions in a peaceful way? For example, jihad of politics, for example, and so on. Because we just expanded jihad to include, for example, economic jihad and so forth, educational jihad and so on. What do brothers and sisters think about that?
We must represent ourselves as a role model to be extremely good Muslim, as our behavior, our character, and tolerance to the opposite society that we are talking about, that is Christianity. So these things will convince them a lot more powerful. These characters are a lot more powerful than anything else. Our behavior, our tolerance, our patience.
Okay.
And that was the reason of the Islam was spread in the early centuries, you know. The non-Muslim, they just was impressed as a role model of the
Muslim.
Practicing Muslim.
Thank you.
As we know that people, perpetrators of this Jihadi Asghar or the wrong misconcept Jihad, we know them very well who they are. But we are not, we know that we cannot address to them or we cannot fight with them. So there is another way that we go to the jihadists and try to change their ideology and try to approach, on their school of thoughts to bring them and sit down with them and talk to them. And can I make a small announcement related to this?
Go ahead, a small one.
Okay. On Sunday, Urdu section of Islamic Center is organizing a milad with all the Muslims, whereas all the schools of Brother Al-Sunnah and Shia is attending. So anybody who would like to come on Sunday, 1 p.m. till 5 p.m. in Islamic Center here. Thank you. It will be Urdu. There are some speeches in English, but mainly it will be in Urdu. And there are the president of the Jamaat Al-Sunnah, Britain, is coming.
Oh, this is considered related. In connection to what the sister was saying, was being more educated, and in connection with jihad, I want to ask a question so that I can understand a bit a verse in the Quran in connection with jihad, I think. I remember a verse in the Quran, which, from what I remember and understand, understood from it, it says in four holy months, we're not allowed to fight in those four holy months. But I'm confused because
not allowed to attack.
Not allowed to attack.
But
yeah,
defense,
initiate fighting.
Defense, yeah.
Yeah. I thought anyway we're not supposed to initiate fighting anyway. Number one, and so if we're attacked, we have to fight back. Just wanted to understand a bit more if it's still connected.
Like for example, when a non-Muslim, even with non-Muslims, Muslims are not allowed to initiate an attack, in the sacred months, but if they attack in those sacred months, like Saddam, I think I remember they attacked in the sacred months, and of course Iran had to defend itself. So even if a Muslim oppressor starts attacking another Muslim nation or country, the defense is allowed, but of course initiating is not allowed, especially in fighting among Muslims, were there as well, which they shouldn't have had, but I mean, they violated all the laws of sacred months to create wars and battles. Just wrapping up, suppose Muslims were a race, not a religion, not people of a religion, a race. And they didn't have a book, they didn't have any idea about jihad. But what has happened to them in the past century? I'm sure they would have invented concepts and ideologies to fight back. It's not, of
like
course, now, yeah, like Christianity, like any other nation. I mean, now, of course, because we have this concept of jihad, this is the best concept that they can use to fight back. But it's not because of this concept that we are in this situation. It's because of the situation brought about by the powers who, the conquerors of the Second World War, who created the order, and they did it very unjustly. They implanted a country in Muslim lands, and they supported it. And unless and until this root of problem is removed, we are going to have the same thing. Now, it has been, it's expanding everywhere. Initially, it was just contained and restricted to jihad about Palestine and such things. Now it's expanding everywhere. And I think I have heard in comments that many people, many Western analysts have also mentioned that this is the root of the problem. We are not in this situation because Muslims believe in jihad or there were jihadis or such things, because this injustice, always injustice creates turmoil, injustice creates violence, and injustice cannot create peace. Those who are after a peace process or peace treaty in the Middle East, I think they should have found after these decades that it's impossible, because injustice cannot produce peace. It's only justice which can produce peace. And in this way, you are not going to succeed to make a peace. If peace is not there, it's not going to be anywhere. You cannot contain it in one part of the world, especially nowadays, and say, okay, you fight each other, we are secure here, sitting back and just watching and seeing what would be the outcome. This is not possible. So as long as the root of the problem is removed, neither Muslims should be condemned and criticized about the jihad, nor anyone else should expect that this is going to be ended. It is not the case that Muslim preachers or thinkers come out and say, look, this is not jihad, stop it, and they listen. They don't listen, of course. Why? Because they are angry. Because they think that there is a source of this injustice there which is driving them towards this violence. And if we want a peaceful world, which we want, if we want a world of coexistence, which all of us want, I think those who have the higher power should think more. They cannot just do whatever they want because of their power. People will fight back with their blood. And if blood spills, it's not only their blood which is spilled. More blood is spilled. This is something which we have to think about. That's my argument.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. This is a very deep subject, and I'm sure a lot of us would be going away thinking about a whole lot of other questions, ideas that would come to our mind with respect to this particular question. I mean, for example, if we want to talk also about, you know, having an impact upon this particular situation in Palestine and so on, it must go back to the strength of Muslim communities themselves. You know, our state of disorganization,
our state of division between us and so on, all of these things contribute to this type of situation that leads to frustration and people taking these type of drastic and un-Islamic activities in response. I want to thank you all for joining us here.